Welcome to episode 2 of the Firehouse Forum podcast, and happy holidays. This should be dropping the week before Christmas and right after Hanukkah. So as we're taping, we are still thawing out from the first major snow in Richmond. So we survived the snow, the first snowpocalypse. We survived the first episode of the podcast, and we figured out at least a couple of the technical issues involved in doing a podcast. And when I say we've figured it out, I mean Ryan Dygert, our sound engineer, has figured them out, because I certainly have no idea how all that stuff works. But hopefully this will sound better. We have high standards here at the Firehouse, so we're working hard to reach ever higher quality standards. One thing I learned from the first podcast is that I'm really bad at doing housekeeping and promotion. So I didn't mention that one of Richmond's favorite sons, composer and actor Jason Marks, wrote and orchestrated the music that we play on the podcast here. So thank you, Jason. I also should have been talking up all the great performances that we have here at the Firehouse that were scheduled a couple weeks ago. But now we're going into the holiday dark period. So when we come back in the new year, you can expect me talking about things like Mary C. Brown that was just here, and the 50 Shades All-Male Review. So we regularly have burlesque and cabarets and all sorts of great stuff here at the Firehouse. So I'm going to try not to screw that up in the future. Okay, this is our year-end episode. It's a little weird doing a year-end episode when it's only our second podcast, but I'm thinking we may treat every episode as the last potential podcast that we do. So put a lot of energy and pop into it, thinking it's our last one. So we've got some great guests coming up. Deborah Clinton, who is an actress, playwright, teacher, and director. And she directed Heathers here at the Firehouse over the summer. And her production of The Miracle on South Division Street is currently at Virginia Rep's Hanover stage. And for the Aren't They Awesome segment this week, it's going to be Caleb Wade, who is an actor and model. He was one of the stars of Heathers, and he is currently in the Andrews Brothers, currently at Swift Creek Mill Playhouse. And we're going to wrap it up with Bo Wilson, who was and still is, I guess, technically the playwright in residence until the end of this year here at the Firehouse. So that's who's up, and we'll get started with that right now. Okay, we're here with Lauren Bacall. No, I'm sorry. We're here with Deborah Clinton, actress, director, teacher, artistic director. She is just everything. She has developed shows like Croaker the Frog Prince with Jason Marks. She is an RTCC nominee for The Winter's Tale as an actress. She is the 2013 recipient of the Teresa Pollock Award for Excellence in Theater. I'm glowing in the bath. I'm basking in the glow of Deborah Clinton right
now.
That
sounds so ironical.
Well, it's just great to have you here. Part of the reason I asked you to come in is because you directed Heathers here at the Firehouse in collaboration with Theater Lab this past year. And you are currently, your directed production of
Miracle on South Division Street.
Thank you. I keep wanting to put a number in there, and I know there's no number there.
Well, it took me a while before I could remember if it was north or south, so you're okay.
All right. Well, thank you for that saving grace there. So you've been very busy this year. So this whole show is going to be people who've had very busy years. So that's part of why I wanted to bring you in also. I wanted to take the opportunity to say Happy Hanukkah, which I don't get a chance to say to a lot of people. Unfortunately, we are recording the day before Hanukkah starts, and this is going to drop the day after Hanukkah ends. So we have to get into now. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah to you too.
All right. Do you have celebrations planned with your family?
Well, this is such a, the Jews being a nomadic people, yes. We will be celebrating our Hanukkah in North Carolina on New Year's Eve.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
With my extended family. But I will light candles tomorrow night. Will you?
I absolutely will. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to bring you in also, because last week I asked Kerrigan Sullivan, what does a director do? So I've already asked somebody that. I'm not going to ask you that question. But a question that I get a lot is, are there people who actually make a living doing theater in Richmond? You know, it's a smaller market. How do people do that? And my answer is often they do a lot of things, and you are kind of the epitome of that. So how do you juggle all these things that you do?
That is the question that everyone wants to know. I'm a hologram.
Okay.
And no.
Where's the real you? Yes.
In this room right now.
Okay.
Here's the thing. I'm really fortunate. I run a theater company for the JCC, the Jewish Family Theater. So I get to make the decisions.
Okay.
I get to make the schedules. Because my thing about directing is communication and scheduling.
Okay.
So if you can do those two things successfully, you have a very good chance of running your life the way you want it.
Okay.
I'm not going to say I don't work hard. I do work hard. It isn't really hard when it's what you love.
Okay.
A lot of it is my schedule, and I'm really kind of, I plan. Believe it or not, I really plan a lot. And I surround myself with good people so that if, God forbid, I can't be somewhere, I have planned for that.
Okay.
And it's really about the schedule. For instance, at the JCC, if I know that I have to rehearse a show, I'm a very fast blocker. I come in with a plan. Plans can change. You have to take cues from your actors, and things evolve in rehearsal. But I do a lot of work up front.
Okay.
And I come in, I often say it's like a jigsaw puzzle. I do the frame so everybody knows where they are, and then we kind of fill in the pieces. If you can give people certain tools, your process becomes much easier. And if, but you know, it's different for different people. Right. I'm a fast person. You know that about me. I do have a northern mentality of like, I want to just get things done.
Right.
And so I come in with a plan and I schedule really carefully, and I'm usually not early. I'm usually typically on time because I have scheduled myself.
Right.
I probably do a little over scheduling and could give myself a little more wiggle room.
Now, it's interesting to me because that none of that sounds artistic, and people think of theater artists as this big artistic vision, but this is very like,
Dave, I'm not an artist.
Oh, you sure?
I gotta shatter the myth. I'm a really practical person who loves theater.
Okay.
But I am. I'm oddly practical.
I guess I'm wondering, for people who listen who think they have to have a great artistic vision, is it more important to have artistic vision, or is it important to be like organized and plan?
It's a good question. Yeah. I think obviously you have to have both.
Hmm.
I think, well, everything that I do comes from a place inside of me, you know, my intuitive instinct of what I see and what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have learned over the years that the discovery part of the process is very important for actors. And in order to get a truly collaborative product, you do have to allow for that.
Right.
But honestly, most people do not like to have their time wasted.
Right.
And if you can come in with a plan, and plans change. But for instance, you're in a show and there's 40 people in it and your scene is at the end.
Right.
By the time I get to you, you're going to be in a really bad mood.
Right.
So either I schedule you first.
Right.
Or I schedule you later. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you still have to wait, but you're in a much better mood about it.
Yeah.
And I often say 2.5 really good hours with actors is much, you get much more out of it than 5 sort of strung together hours that might be less productive. Now, you know what? Every artist does their art in the way that is right for them.
Right. Okay.
Maybe I'm more of a producer than a director. I don't know. I'm a storyteller, so I think I tell good stories.
Okay.
But people just, time is so valuable.
Right. Well, and I think about South Division Street. Those are very professional actors. I imagine that Kathy Schaffner isn't going to come in and say, let's discover what we're trying to find here. That they're, I don't know, you explain how that plays out.
Well, I'm probably going to reveal too much, so I'll apologize in advance, Nathaniel, if I say things I'm not supposed to. But you bring up a good example. And I think sometimes it's about skill and ability level and experience. I do think it's a lot about experience. If you're an experienced actor or director, you know what to do. You're not coming into rehearsal to learn how to rehearse.
Okay.
You're just coming in to do your craft.
Right.
So I got incredibly lucky with some of the best actors in Richmond.
Yeah.
And a play that is lovely. It's kind of, you know what to do with this play. It's not, it takes a lot of dexterity and skill, but it's not rocket science. This play sort of, it's easy to understand.
Okay.
And so we all came in kind of ready to go. And we had to, because we had a really, really short rehearsal period.
Oh, really? How
like
long?
Shorter than usual.
Okay.
Because we had some really big conflicts. And Nathaniel and I discussed it at length. And we were like, but these people are the right people for the roles.
Right.
And I, you know, we talked about it and I said, I believe we can do what we need to do. I think we literally had maybe 12 rehearsals before we went into tech.
Wow, that's not many.
And I have to tell you, when we opened, they may have wanted another one or two to feel super comfortable, but the show was ready.
Right.
Was really ready. Yeah. But you can do that. You know, when I was a kid, we had summer stock and we would like do shows in 10 days,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
We live in a community where you can't rehearse all day and rehearse all night because people have jobs.
Yeah.
I just got lucky. I don't think I could have done that with larger, more unwieldy casts.
Okay.
I just had the right combination of people.
Well, and you mentioned unwieldy. Well, first of all, you mentioned Nathaniel a couple times. I want to make sure people know that's Nathaniel Shaw.
I'm sorry, it's Nathaniel Shaw, Artistic Director of Virginia Repertory Theater.
Okay, cool. Thanks. So working on a show like Heather's that you did here, that is a much bigger cast, much younger cast. Well, I mean, you've got a mix of ages currently for South Division, but that's a...
I think experience-wise, it was a younger cast.
Right.
We had a lot of new faces
okay.
to the Richmond theater scene.
So was there more wrangling involved in that, or did they all pretty much come ready to go?
No, they were so enthusiastic about the project.
Yeah,
everybody, you know, Heather's is a piece that people have great passion about. It's not even a cult play. It's just something people love and want. Everybody came in feeling very lucky to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was difficult material,
yeah,
really difficult material, and for many other reasons, more complex. I think just the storyline and trying to do it justice, trying not to be the movie, trying to make the characters fleshed out and real in a show that's designed kind of like sound bites of songs and things. Very different feel.
Okay.
And a lot of different styles to meld together. And the music, and this is a nod to the musical director, Jason Marks, really difficult music to sing.
Hmm. Okay. Well, it turned out pretty darn good.
That was another one where I was like, we're ready.
Yeah.
I think that you, I want to say this correctly. It is a tribute to your actors and your show when you're able to take your hands off of it and go, okay, you guys... Let it be yours now. That's
okay.
My job, I think, as the director.
It sounds much like a mother, basically.
Or Moses.
Okay. I wasn't going to make that leap, but that's, yeah.
You know, so he got them almost there, but he couldn't go in.
Okay, I see.
Never mind. You can cut all that part out. Maybe. Mm. I mean, I think what you're saying is that I don't know what you're saying. Are you saying I mother my cast?
Well, I just think of that analogy of, you know, the baby bird, you push it out of the nest and it has to be ready to fly.
Well, and it's got to fly whether it's ready or not.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the doing is when you learn it.
Okay.
And I do think that theater is like that. You can plan and plan and plan.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what is going to happen until you go out on that stage and things happen.
Yeah.
And what you have to do, I think, is give people the emotional and artistic tools to be prepared for anything.
Okay. Well, and now I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work at Jewish Family Theater. So you're the artistic director there.
Mm-hmm.
What is that job? I mean, do you, and people can't see that Dev is having all sorts of reactions over there. So are you, you're in charge there, but you work with the board, and I can imagine.
I'm in charge of a very small cog and a very big wheel.
Okay.
I have, you know, there's a lot that surrounds Jewish Family Theater.
Yeah.
First of all, for a community theater, I like to think that we do really good work. I know that we're a pretty important part of the fabric of what happens at the Weinstein JCC. Over the years, I'm actually in my 10th year.
Wow.
Right. You know, 10 years of anything. And so that feels good because I think we've raised the profile. We've raised the bar of what we do, the level. We have great audience attendance. People really support us. And we've been able to sort of open the door into the wider Richmond community and be like, look at us. Look at what we do here. So all that's really great. That being said, a bajillion other things go on at the JCC on any given day.
Yeah.
And you have to be flexible and you have to be smart and you have to plan and you have to figure things out.
Right.
I'm laughing because you've been to the JCC, so that room is like a room.
Right.
It's
yeah.
not a theater.
It's a big auditorium.
With a stage and
yeah.
chairs that they fold up and put away. Right. And I am so blessed. Oh, I don't want to say blessed. I am so fortunate because I am surrounded with people who want to work hard like me to make magic happen.
Okay.
And they are so devoted and dedicated. And I work with this team, this creative team of, and I work with the same people pretty much over and over, people like Kevin Johnson and Michael Jarrett and my wonderful stage manager, who is only now 16 years old, because, you know, I find them when they're babies and I raise them and they go fly. But we all share a similar vision. Okay. An ethic. And so we know how to make the show magic. So we've been really lucky because we've gotten to have a lot of people come in who want to be part of that. And I don't know. My mom and I were talking and she was like, I hope you never leave the JCC because it's very important to you and your Jewishness. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, it's your give back.
Hmm.
And maybe it is. Okay. I'm not particularly religious,
right,
but I'm definitely Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of combining my passion for theater with my heritage,
right,
and my culture. And so somehow that fulfills me on a lot of levels. So, you know, I love it. It's hard. It's,
yeah,
complicated, but it's really worth it.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you say that because you said you kind of poo-pooed the notion that you're an artist. But, you know, I recently wrote a story about Triangle Players, and they were talking about how these days, not, you know, any company can do a gay themed play in a way that wasn't true 10 or 15 years ago. And so one of the things that I think is important in an artistic sense is to have different voices and to highlight different voices. And that is something that you're doing at Jewish Family Theater, is that you are, that is a theme. There are themes that you're going to explore there that won't necessarily be explored other places.
Or through the same prism.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's that whole other argument about who should do what play.
Right.
Right?
Well,
and I think there's
South Division Street is not a Jewish play. It is? Oh, okay.
Wink, wink. Hmm. Go see it.
Okay.
But I've done plays that, I mean, I work outside of the JFT and I do all kinds of things. But I think there's value in different people telling the same story from different points of view.
Hmm.
So if Virginia Rapp wants to do Fiddler, great.
Right.
If JFT wants to do Fiddler, okay, great. If West End Assembly of God wants to do Fiddler, okay, great.
Right.
You're going to get three different Fiddlers.
Yeah.
And the analogy of how do you find out what the real news is, you have to watch all the news channels.
Right. Yeah.
And then not listen to any of them. No. But you know what I'm saying? To get all the points of view.
Sure.
I think I don't believe that anyone has one right answer.
Okay. I like that. I like that answer. So what's next for you coming up?
Well, I have a quieter,
okay,
rest of the year, which I really like. I'm a full-time theater arts teacher in Hanover County.
Okay.
Which, oddly, it's not odd, but I do love it, and for a lot of reasons. But I do three shows a year there, so I have a couple of big things coming up with them. And I am... We're doing a Richmond premiere for Acts of Faith with Jewish Family Theater called Stars of David,
okay,
which I do not think, I know it has not been done in Richmond, but it's a musical review based on a book by Abigail Pogrin. I hope I pronounced that right, Pogrin. And it's all about Jewish celebrities,
wow,
and politicians and their stories. And the music, it's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Norman Lear and Fran Drescher and Michael Feinstein, and the music is written by people like Jason Robert Brown and Maltby Shire and just a lot of contemporary composers.
Oh, very interesting.
It's a little bit, well, at JFT, we really do try to find stories other than Fiddler to tell. And this seemed to me to be a really good merge of contemporary American life and just exploring the contributions and kind of where people come from. We'll do a live band with it. I'm surrounded by musical talent that's going to be working on the project. Have not had auditions.
Okay.
Unlike everyone. No, I shouldn't say that. I just don't make a practice of auditioning too far in advance.
Okay.
Because I like when people take the job for them to keep the job.
I see. Yes.
But I'm excited about it because I think there are a few things about it that will make it attractive to the larger community.
Great. Well, and you've given a good preview of, I'm sure next year, we're going to be talking all about Acts of Faith. We always do. It's always a big deal. So come February, there'll be much more Acts of Faith news. Okay. Well, I think that'll do it. Thank you so much for coming in. And I want you to stick around because we're going to have Caleb on next. And
I'm excited to see Caleb.
All right.
He's very busy.
Yes, he is. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Now we're here. In addition to Deb Clinton, still, we have Caleb Wade, who is an actor, model, singer. This is the show of multi-hyphenates. he is currently appearing in the Andrews Brothers at Swift Creek Mill Playhouse. He has been in almost everything you've seen in this past year. He was in Heathers, directed by Deb Clinton. He was in the year before. He was in 1776. He was in American Idiot. He was in Cloud Nine. He was in, he's been in everything. So this is also the theme of this show. It's very, very busy people. And so it seems to me, and you can contradict me if you want, that suddenly you are in everything. And is that something that happened consciously that you started auditioning for everything again? Or is it, how did this develop that you're suddenly busy all the time?
I mean, actually, I do not audition as much as I should. Oh. And when you don't audition enough, you can, you know, that muscle can get weaker. Uh-huh. So specifically lately, I have started auditioning. We're just trying to make sure that I'm strengthening that muscle and being continuing to get good at that part of the craft.
Okay.
Because that's a whole other thing. The fun thing about acting, especially in a community like this, is good or bad, people start knowing what you do. Or people start, you know...
People notice you.
They learn of you. They know, oh, that's a person that is working in the town, blah, blah, blah. And so you can start getting to be asked to do certain projects, et cetera. And it's kind of been a combination of both, auditioning and then meeting good people and that leading to other projects.
Okay. Well, and like a lot of actors in town, for me at least, because I've been here forever, there's people that you start to notice and then suddenly you see more and more of them.
Sure.
So I'm not sure, can you lay out your career trajectory for me? Where did you went to VCU, right?
Yeah, I went to VCU, but I went to VCU for music.
Okay.
I was a trumpet player, and I was a very serious trumpet player. That's what I wanted to do. I was set on that.
No smiling.
And that's kind of part of it. About halfway through my college career at VCU, the smiling, the fun of it kind of fell out of it.
Oh, no.
And I realized, as much as I always loved playing trumpet, whether it's in marching band or pits for musicals or, you know, any number of things, I didn't really love playing it as much as I used to, you know? It's one of those things where you're just thinking about what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And the idea of just sitting in a practice room for 8 hours a day playing trumpet.
Yeah, not so much fun.
You know, and I wanted to do more. I wanted more out of life. I'd done like some acting stuff when I was younger, but it's, you know, that's when you're young. It's not really serious stuff. But it's something that I'd always been in the entertainment community. I was in management for the entertainment department in Kings Dominion for a good number of years. And I was always, but I was always on the management side of things.
Huh, so you weren't one of the people walking the streets of Kings Dominion or the stages?
No, I wasn't in the shows. I was in the dress-up characters for Nickelodeon when they were still at Kings Dominion, but I was, you know, 15, 16 years old doing that.
Okay.
But you, being on that side of it, I'd always had the bug. I'd always wanted to get to the other side. I'd always wanted to get on stage. I'd always wanted to, and I always got along with the casts. I always had talked about the desire to, you know, start getting to singing and acting and blah, 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 right? So finally I did. and it was kind of one of those things where I had a couple friends who kind of introduced me to it, to the right people, and that let me get a leg into different areas, and I was able to start kind of trying things. Started community theater a few years ago. And it's funny because, you know, for as many musicals as I do now, I was raised being told by my family that I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket if I had to. I was my father's son to the end of the day on that one.
Okay.
Thanks, Deb. and it wasn't until I went for a community theater production of Sound of Music a few years ago.
Oh, okay.
And the director said, "Do you sing?" And I said, "No, absolutely not." She was like, "Okay, well, here's this non-singing role. Great." Hmm. But then in rehearsals, she would hear me in the back of the room singing along with the people going through the singing scenes. Oh, right? And she was like, I thought you said you don't sing. I was like, I don't. That's right. What my parents have always told me. She's like, okay, well, you're auditioning for the next musical next time for a vocal part. And then it was South Pacific, and I ended up playing Lieutenant Cable.
Oh, nice.
Community theater production, but it was one of those things where it was a great production, and I learned so much. I started getting confidence in the idea that, oh, maybe I can sing. And from the rest is kind of history. I've just been doing it as much as I can.
That's pretty wild. Well, I'm sorry. I feel like I've ruined it, that sometime you could be in a production down the road that calls for a trumpet player, and you're going to people are going to be like, holy crap.
Well, you know, it's one of those. I mean, I've still been able to incorporate trumpet a couple of times so far into productions, but not so much probably within the last 3 years or so, just because as much as I loved trumpet, it's one of those things where my focus has been on really honing the craft of acting and being on that side.
But
of
someone could do like Sideman or something.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, there's so many good plays that combine, you know, playing an instrument, you're really lucky because that's very trendy to be on stage acting and playing an instrument.
Well, American Idiot, you know, two summers ago now. I mean, when I did that show, I mean, I was playing bass, I played bass a little bit in high school with some of my best friends. We started our band.
Right.
But at that point, I'd never played and sung at the same time. And all of a sudden for this show, okay, play bass and act, sing, dance, do the entire show,
right.
But also play the entire album while doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, I grew a lot that summer. We'll put it that way.
I can imagine. Jeez.
It was fun.
Well, part this segment of the podcast is called They're So Awesome. And the reason I wanted you here to say why you're so awesome, in my mind, is the show Cloud Nine that closed at Triangle Players recently is, and we had Jesse Johnson here a couple weeks ago, and it's a show where all the actors play dramatically different roles in one act versus the other one. And particularly in the second act of Cloud Nine, you play a 5-year-old girl, typecasting, obviously.
Okay.
And what I really thought was awesome about your performance, well, two things. Your accent in the first act, you played South African, African-American native.
Uh-huh.
Great accent. And then in the second act, a 5-year-old girl, you would think some people would play as precious.
Mm.
You played her as annoying as hell and did a great job at it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, so it was a great job.
I'm sorry, I'll weigh in a minute. You keep talking.
Okay.
So that's why one of the ways I thought you're pretty awesome. So, Deb, you can weigh in right now.
Because I saw that production as well. I loved the complete change in your physicality, which I thought it takes a high level of skill. And I will say, you are an actor that responds really well to direction, and you had a really good director for that show. And I think, and we talked about this, I think,
that was Rusty Wilson.
Yes, I'm sorry, Rusty Wilson. I think you really gained some knowledge or some ways to do things from working with him.
For sure.
I won't say you really grew because that's sort of precious, but you know what I mean? He's really good with actors, and I think he encouraged you to take things to another level.
The best thing about working with Rusty, and that was my first and only time working with him so far. Mm-hmm. I'd love to work with him again, Rusty. but he really gives everybody in the cast the room to find their characters, to find and grow and try different things, not worry about doing things that won't work, you know? He gives you the opportunity to play and just find what it is that you want to put on the stage. And it was just such an open, warm, creative environment that he allowed us to work in.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And you're right. I know that I grew in that production.
You also had the good fortune to be on stage with really talented people. And that's also how you learn and get better.
Yep, you're right. And I mean, it doesn't get much better than a cast like that. You know,
it's a good cast.
Lance Hatterfield, Andrew Ferda, Jesse Johnson, Larry Cook, et cetera. It was just, I loved being a part of that cast. And I learned just playing a scene with one of them and just looking in their eyes and seeing what it is that they're giving you in the moment, you can take that and apply it to things and just learn from those little moments as opposed to, and as well as, you know, watching what they're doing, you know, just when, you know, first scenes that you're not in, et cetera. I mean, right. It was basically a masterclass.
Well, and as a theater fan, what's really exciting for me is to see people like, you know, Larry Cook and Lane and all these people that I've seen do incredible things over the years and have somebody younger, maybe not as well known, totally hold your own in on stage with them. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, I appreciate that. Maybe didn't it we I it was a level to strive towards.
Well said.
You know what I mean? we're gonna put it that way. No, but it's great. And I mean that's essentially what it's been working in this town at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean working in theater in this community has been my education. And I'm learning and growing with every production that I do. And I'm very fortunate to get to continue to be able to do different productions where I'm really playing completely different roles in just about every show I do.
Right.
You know?
Well, and in your current production, you get to make out with George Rogers Farmer.
Which,
so, you know,
it doesn't
that.
Get much better than that. Come on. No, I love Georgia. She's great.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that, in you know, I'm opening up a box that you can shut right down again if you want.
Okay.
But I just remember we had a conversation after Cloud Nine once, and you were talking about pictures from Heather's coming out that had you and another actor, you know, with your shirt, without your shirt on.
The portrait?
No, the production photos.
Oh, those pictures?
Yeah.
Yes.
In full?
Well, regalia. Almost full.
Or
yeah.
Lack of regalia. Yeah.
Down to your skivvies.
We had
skivvies
some nice undies on. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the things, and this is something, it's, again, it's a bigger topic, but, you know, there is a certain level of objectivity that happens in theater.
Sure.
You know, people get cast because they are good looking.
Yeah.
Did you feel awkward in to be, you know, to see those pictures and to be presented in that way?
No, I didn't. And I think I didn't because that's part of the story. Those characters are not, they're not, that's not really what that those moments are about in the show. So being, I mean, in our underwear essentially is just, it was a circumstance of the moment. And it's kind of,
so it seemed authentic.
In this. Exactly. Okay. So it didn't, that's not something that I was self-conscious about or really thinking about. You know, because you're more thinking about what's actually going on in the scene. And I mean, you know, yeah, that thought disappeared.
Well, I'll chime in.
Okay, yeah, please do.
You know, I'm not a big fan of gratuitous anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, oh, do we need to? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I guess we do. I always thought that moment was really genuine because there was always a tinge of embarrassment.
Yeah.
But it works for the story
and
it amplified just what immature idiots those particular characters were. It didn't make you hate them or want to, you know, denigrate them in any way. It just sort of personified kind of what their characters were all about. And it was also this great moment of them being completely vulnerable.
Right.
Which I loved.
Yes.
And thought also amplified the story.
Right.
I agree completely.
So you were only cast because you looked good in your underwear.
Well,
that was my follow-up question.
You didn't know how I was going to look in my underwear.
No, so. I didn't. I really never thought about it.
Neither did I.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is another thing in general, though. I mean, I've never been one to be like, hey, I think that I'm attractive. I think I'm good looking, et cetera, et cetera. But people have told me in the past it helps to be pretty to when it comes to being cast in certain ways. But the thing that I've always held on to is that if that is what I'm being cast for, then I don't want to do it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of that goes into casting anybody in anything because you have to fit a certain role from a physical perspective, from a look perspective, from a height perspective, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But I want to be good at this craft.
Right.
I want to be able to go into a room and know that I'm going to be able to act this well. I'm going to be able to sing this well. I'm going to be able to move. I won't say dance. I'll say move this well. But I want to do this because I love the craft. I love the art, just everything that goes into performing and acting and...
And telling stories.
And telling stories. Yeah. I'm in love with telling stories. And that love only deepens and grows the more that I do this.
Oh, that's great.
And so it's to the point now where I couldn't imagine doing anything else. You know what I mean?
So your next story that you're going to be involved in, Brave New World for Quill, that's opening in February, I think.
February 2nd.
Okay.
And that's the 17th.
That seems like that could be a challenging story to tell.
It's going to be very different, for sure. And I am so excited about it. I mean, you talk about good casts, another great cast.
Right.
And to get to work with Maggie Roop as a director is something I've always wanted to do. I've only worked with her as a co-actor. So I'm very excited about that. And it'll be my first real time working with Quill. I did a short summer show with them a couple years ago, but this will be my first like full production with them, and I'm very excited about it. It's going to be good.
Well, and I expect, given the track record recently, you're going to be in something else like immediately after that.
We'll see. I mean, you're always auditioning.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, I think that'll do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I really appreciate it. Okay. We are here with Bo Wilson. He is a playwright, writer, actor, director. One thing I don't mention nearly enough when I talk about Bo or to Bo is about his voiceover talent, which we were just talking about. He has directed shows like Shining City, Last Days of Judas Iscariot, God of Carnage, and several more. I asked him in to talk to us today because he has just spent the year 2017 as the artist in residence, playwright in residence. Playwright in residence at the Firehouse. No other act. You weren't doing any like scribbling on the wall or anything like that. Okay. So you've been a playwright in residence at the Firehouse this past year, and this is kind of our year-end wrap-up. So your play, The Boat Ride. Sorry about that. Yeah, well, we'll invite you back for the next big time. Christmas party. Your play, The Boat Ride, opened here in February.
That's right.
And Food, Clothing, and Shelter ran in September for too few performances, if you ask me.
But, I appreciate that. if you blinked, you missed it.
Yeah. Well, those who were awake and aware and came out and saw it, I think enjoyed a really great new world premiere show. And so it seems to me like it's been a pretty busy year for you. Has it felt like one to you?
Yeah, it was a sort of two-tiered experience because The Boat Ride really didn't involve me other than showing up and saying, hey, look what you guys did.
Hey, showing up is 80% of the work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, the play was done. It was published, and there was no work to be done, and Gary Hopper cast it and directed it, and I came to opening and said, wow, neat. But I was already working on Food, Clothing, and Shelter, which Joel and I had actually talked about the August before. And we put together a group of mostly actors, although there were some producers and directors and designers who showed up, called the Firehouse Working Group.
Okay.
And the working group met every 2 or 3 weeks here at the Firehouse. And I would arrange for the meeting, and whoever wanted to come would come. And they would read whatever I had that was new since the last time we had met.
Okay.
And so that was very useful, just in the sense of, okay, I'd better come up with some new pages, because these guys they're not going to like reading the same thing they had last week.
Right.
So there was that level of work going on.
And so they would come in and they would actually perform the
perform is too big a word, probably, but we would sit in a circle in chairs around a table, or sometimes just on the stage, a circle of chairs, and just we'd have copies. Joel would have copies of the pages available, and we'd pass them around and read them, and I'd say, okay, now let's stop, and now you read that guy, and we'd change the parts around if we had enough people to do that.
Okay.
So that's not very production specific. That's all about me having a chance to hear the words and find out, oh, that doesn't work.
And that's different than like normally you would do. You wouldn't normally produce or develop a play that way.
Well, I like to have. If I've got a new draft of a play, in fact, I'm going to be trying to do this at some point in 2018 when I have something ready. I like to have a couple of friends over to the house and just read it, you know, feed them. And feed them and give
them, we've done with you.
Feed them and give them some wine or something, and you know, people show up and just hear it. You know, not as a public event, and the working group meetings weren't public events either. But there's great benefit in hearing the work read by people that are reasonably skilled, but it hasn't been rehearsed, it hasn't been overthought. And occasionally there's something where, oh, they don't realize that this character is drunk in this scene. But okay, so let's stop and go back and load that in. But I like having that. Excuse me. I like having that that first aural experience with the work, and it generally confirms a fair number of things that I'm hoping are going to be there, and sometimes it reveals unexpected weakness or something that I thought took a really long time on the page. It happens in 30 seconds and I realize, oh, okay, I'm going to need to add something to that. Or something that I thought moved very swiftly takes too long, and now we have had time to forget the thing that I need us to remember, so okay, I've got to find a way to drop it in there somewhere for a reminder. So there's value both in terms of, is the story clear? Are the rhythms working? Are the characters making sense? Do we believe what's going on? And, you know, if you have good actors who come in and read for you, they'll tell you, you know, even if it's just sitting around a table, they'll say, why doesn't she just leave, you know, or whatever.
Don't open that door.
Right. So I tend to lean on that pretty heavily. But what was great and new about the working group experience was that it was piecemeal.
Okay.
What I'm describing, you know, I finish a first draft and then I call two or three or four terribly forgiving friends of mine and say, would you please come? But in this case, it was sort of like, here's 17 pages. I'm not sure where they're going to go. Here's this scene. I know this scene is basically the shape that I want it, but I don't know if it's going to come before this one or after that one. Mm-hmm. And so to a certain extent, it was it was kind of like making a jigsaw puzzle piece by piece rather than doing the whole picture and then cutting it up into pieces, which I think is probably the smarter way to do it. So that was, it kept my shoulder to the wheel work-wise. It kept me sort of focused, and I said somewhere recently, maybe it was just a Facebook post, but this year I've written 3.5 plays and various and sundry short scenes and other things. I've never had a year where I wrote that much, and I'm pretty sure that the working group is a big part of why.
Okay. And in conversations we've had before about this experience, you've mentioned that you thought that you could see other companies doing this kind of, you know, playwright in residence.
Oh, sure. I mean, the residential model is not an invention of ours.
Right.
What we had to invent was a sort of, the working group was our way of addressing the fact that when it's Trinity Rep or Actors Theater of Louisville or the Guthrie or what have the Goodman, they tend to have, or Oregon Shakespeare, which has got a big new play process happening now. They have a resident company. They job actors in and out, but they've got a core of 10 or 12 people that are there for the season. They have season-long contracts.
Okay.
And those are the people who are presumed to be kind of available to the playwright in residence. You know, hey, I got a new scene. Can we go into rehearsal room B and read it? Well, who's free? Well, he's not doing anything right now.
Nice.
You know, so if you don't have a resident company, you need some way to mimic that kind of ad hoc, you know, test drive of these pages or this scene or what have you. Mm-hmm. So the working group was something that we kind of invented. But the notion of having a playwright who's around all the time working on stuff and periodically throws new pages out there and says, let's hear these, that's pretty well established, I think. And we can always use more of it. There aren't nearly enough theaters doing it.
Right. Well, and you know, it kind of dovetails with, you know, something that I've thought about for a long time. We've talked about it, is the development of new work in Richmond. And, you know, in my mind, development of new work and work that can then travel to other places, you know, burnishes the reputation of a place.
Sure.
And it seems like you're one of the main people who, you know, are kind of at the forefront of that kind of activity here in Richmond. Do you think it's increasing? Do you think there's opportunities for it to grow?
Well, we'll have to see. I think there are a couple pieces that originated at what was then Theater 4. Red Hot and Cold, I think, gets done now and again. I think one of Doug Jones' pieces, I don't know if it's Songs from Bedlam or maybe it's his Turn of the Screw, but one of his pieces, mm-hmm. I think, gets done elsewhere. And, you know, it's Irene Ziegler, Rules of the Lake, I think, has been done elsewhere.
Right.
So, and sometimes it just, it depends. The tricky thing is that a theater will often be willing to do a brand new play because, yeah, nobody knows what it is. It's risky. It's an unknown title, but we get to do the world premiere, and there's a certain cachet. Once you've had the world premiere, I was talking to Dave Robbins about this. He was really frustrated because it was before End of War, so maybe it was
Buried Child?
No. Sam and Carol. Was that the name of it? But anyway, we were talking about, you know, the difficulty of getting a second production.
Right.
Because the first production, you have a certain number of theaters that want to world premiere something.
Right.
But now it's still an unknown piece.
Sure.
Unless it world premiered on Broadway. You know, if you have a world premiere at a regional theater, you know, it won't be terribly splashy. A lot of people aren't going to know what it is, and now they don't even get to call it a world premiere. You know, they'll say regional premiere.
Doesn't have the same,
Charitable Sisterhood Christmas show is running right now up in just outside Trenton, New Jersey, and they're calling it a regional premiere because it is.
Right.
But, you know, you want to find some excuse for, I know you've never heard of this, but it's important.
Right. Yeah.
So that's tricky, and in my experience, it has been easier to get musicals or comedies to get a serious look for that second production. A straight drama is a very tricky thing to get a second production out of.
Right.
So, you know, that's the hard part. I mean, it's hard enough to write a play, and then it's hard to convince somebody to do it. And then the fact that it actually ends up in front of scenery and in front of patrons on opening night is
patrons.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of rare. All of that is terribly difficult and uphill. And then all of that is much easier than the second production. So, you know.
So you're saying that it's going to be harder to get Hamilton done here, you know, somebody to develop Hamilton out of Richmond, the next Hamilton?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure how to attack that question even because it has to do
that's
with
my job. Make it
yeah
hard for
yeah
you.
Well, it has to do with is there someone of that. Generally speaking, I think that there's an age, you know, I'm past that age, but there is an age, a youthfulness that says I must climb Everest, I must go to Broadway, I must go to LA, Hollywood, I must make my film, you know. And so if you happen to have located yourself in one of those central organs of production, then if you also happen to be a genius, I like your chances.
Okay,
which is a weird way of saying I'm not sure if you're a genius and you're in your 20s, what we need are various ways to lure you into staying in Richmond or coming to Richmond, you know, because one of the things that happens over and over again in my experience of this town is that someone kind of new and wonderful shows up and we look at one another and say, well, he's not going to be here long.
Right.
Or, you know, when is, and it's all about every, it's not that Richmond is a place to be fled. It's that New York or Hollywood are places to be conquered.
Right.
Yep. So, I've never heard of anyone leaving Richmond because they're really excited about the opportunity in Rhode Island, you know, but it is, I think, endemic to all of the regions that aren't New York or LA.
Right.
That they will, I mean, Chicago probably manages to hold on to some folks. I imagine Minneapolis is able to hold on to some folks. There are centers. Perhaps DC is able to hold on to some folks. But, you know, the very best usually want to take on the very biggest challenge.
Right.
So,
well, and I also feel like there is, and this is something that I talked to Deb Clinton about, who's going to be on this episode as well, is to live here and thrive here as a theater professional, you often have to do like what you've done. You have to be a director. You're not just a playwright. You're an actor, you're a director, you're a voiceover talent, you're all those things.
And I'm tremendously lucky because I've never had to work a real job. And there are some immensely talented people in this market who, you know, theater is what they do after they finish their real job.
Right.
And, you know, I've been wildly fortunate that I have been permitted to do those things that can add up to a mortgage payment. Right. You know, it was every one of them is a stroke of luck one way or the other. Somebody saying, hey, have you ever done this before? We think you might be good at this.
Right.
Like, it hadn't occurred to me, but okay.
Yeah.
You know, what voiceover, that was somebody who called me. I didn't go after that. And directing, you know, James Ricks and Jackie O'Connor kind of reached out to me about True West. And, you know, so, it's been the patchwork aspect of it has been a function of great fortune.
Oh, good. Well, I wanted to tap into your institutional knowledge as well, because some people may not know.
I've been institutionalized.
Right. The people, come on, yes. In. You can take them away now. Some people don't realize, people who haven't been around as long as I have, that you used to work for Theatre Virginia, which was Richmond's only Lort. You know, League
That's
of Rich
where
Regional
I started.
Theaters. And that closed in 2002.
Yep.
So it's been 15, almost 16 years ago. And I was wondering, I wanted to get your perspective, you know, given that this is a year-end show, you know, what is your perspective on how Richmond has changed since that time? That was kind of a, you know, in some ways almost cataclysmic in that it closed, you know, they had been around for 50-some years. But yet theater is still thriving, in my mind, in Richmond. So what has changed? What's the same? You know, what's your perspective on where we stand right now in 30 seconds or less?
When I was at Theatre Virginia, which was primarily the late 80s, but then I jobbed in. I was on their full-time staff 86 to 90. And then I jobbed in as a stage manager periodically for several years after that. In fact, I was on the payroll when the theater went dark.
Okay.
Stage managing a new play that Benny Ambush was directing. Theatre Virginia was about, I'm gonna ballpark it and say 55 or 60 full-time jobs.
Whoa.
Between the administration and the production staff and the artistic staff.
Okay.
There were a lot of people who paid their rent and their bills working only that job.
Wow.
And, you know, if it was a great designer like David Crank or whomever, they would also take other work, but they were on the staff to do these jobs. And, you know, so when it kind of vanished, there were people who had moved to Richmond, actors who had moved to Richmond because they had worked so regularly at Theatre Virginia, and they looked around and they said, I can buy a house for like 3 months worth of rent in this place. Why right. wouldn't I move here and keep working? And you know, suddenly the place where they worked was closed. Now, interestingly, Virginia Rep has kind of, over the last 15 years, has built out into that space.
Okay.
And I think the Rep staff is awfully big. And I think that in many ways, the energies have sort of shifted from the one over to the other. But it is harder now, I think, because the 80s were also kind of a boom time economically.
Okay.
You know, when you talk about voiceovers, if you went to a voiceover job in the 80s, there would be five other talents in the room, and it would be like this little cast sitcom. You know, you might only have one line, but you got paid the same as the guy that had five lines.
Okay.
And then came the 90s, and then came the aughts. And over time, it became, you know, from five people to three people to one person to actually, we don't do commercials anymore. We just put things on the internet.
Wow.
And in that same kind of contraction is a national event economically. There are more jobs, but less pay.
Okay.
So, you know, I haven't done the homework on this. I'm just going to speak as if I know what I'm talking about. But I think that I feel like I read somewhere that
people are
saying that, you know, yes, there are more jobs in the economy now, but the wages are lower, and so you have to work two jobs to make what one job used to pay you.
Right.
The arts are no different, and you know, government subsidy has significantly reduced. Corporate support has sort of focused itself in ways that are make it very competitive. You know, we've got some awfully large corporations in Richmond, but they're not necessarily interested in reaching out a helping hand to smaller companies. There's no image upside for them for that. Hmm. So, you know, there's and you have all these companies competing for the same contributed dollars.
Right.
I just think that overall, the 80s were a time of abundance. There were fewer companies, but the companies that were in town were large. And, you know, Theater Virginia, I want to say that it had as many as 16,000 subscribers at its peak.
Wow. That's like four or five times what theaters are going to have.
I might
these
be
days.
Wrong. It might have only been a little over 12, but even 12 is a lot.
Right.
And then they did tremendous. They played, the Theater Virginia season played to something like 87%.
Okay.
And that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, if your house is mostly full all the time,
right,
that's great.
Yeah.
And so I feel like now people have Netflix, people have there are so many more options for what you're going to do with your evening, and a lot of them involve staying home.
Right.
So that's tricky. You know, there's it's probably a big fat book what has changed since 19, okay. You know, since 2002,
right,
or since 1987. Yeah. But a lot,
yeah.
is okay. The, you know, that's, well, my uneducated answer.
Yeah. Well, and that's just a lot of what I'm trying to explore as part of this podcast, as part of my new job, is how things have changed and how we can make things.
Something
better,
that hasn't changed is that there's a lot of talent in this town.
Yeah, absolutely.
That has not changed, but it is that same group of people have to scrap quite a bit harder to make ends meet than right. was once the case.
Yeah. Well, it is the holidays, and so one of the traditions that that has grown up around you is the Bo Wilson holiday story. So when can we expect that?
I hope that it is public by the end of the week.
Okay. Well, this is
I want to say it's the 27th one or the 28th one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you keep coming up with ideas?
Oh, Christmas stories, they're out there. I mean, you know, it's I don't, you know, where do you get your ideas is a mysterious question to me, because to me it's like, how come you don't have 50 ideas?
Right.
You know, it's I don't want to jinx myself. I may someday wake up and not know any more stories to tell, but right now the trunk continues to overflow, and it's really just a question of which one am I going to choose now.
Oh, that's
and
great.
You know, all year long I say, oh, that would be good for next year's Christmas story, and I say that 10 different times.
Wow.
And I jot it down and put it in a folder on my computer, and then I look at them and I say, all right, that one stinks, that one stinks, that one. Oh, this one was pretty good.
Well, I hope that trunk never runs dry, because
me
it's
too. It's fun. It's fun. It's yeah. You know, playwriting is hard, but the Christmas story is just fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, I think that's going to do it for us. Everybody, look for Bo's story coming out anytime, dropping on Facebook
it's
or on his website.
I think it's called The Farmer and the Saint. I think that's what it's called, okay. Unless I change my mind.
All right. Okay, well, we've been speaking to Bo Wilson, playwright, actor, director, and up until...
And bon vivant.
And bon vivant, yes. Up until a couple days after this drops, he was the playwright in residence here at the Firehouse, so thanks for your service.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, take care. Okay, that'll do it for episode 2 of the Firehouse Forum podcast. Thank you all for tuning in. I wanted to thank my guests once again. It was Deborah Clinton, who directed The Miracle on South Division Street that will be still playing through the end of the year out at the Tavern, Virginia Rep. Also Caleb Wade, who is currently in the Andrews Brothers at Swift Creek Mill and will be starring in Brave New World for Quill in February. Did I say at the Mill or Quill? I can't remember. Anyway, Andrews Brothers is at the Mill. Brave New World's at Quill. And we wrapped up with Bo Wilson, who is a playwright and was our playwright in residence here at the Firehouse for the year. Look for his Christmas story probably posted on his Facebook page by now. Thanks again for tuning in to the Firehouse Forum. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Happy New Year.